struck in the pickle rooms, and he might have a sore that would put him out of the world. All the joints in his fingers might be eaten by the acid, one by one. Of the butchers and floorsmen, the beef boners and trimmers, and all those who used knives, you could scarcely find a person who had the use of his thumb. Time and time again, the base of it had been slashed, till it was a mere lump of flesh against which the man pressed the knife to hold it. The hands of these men would be crisscrossed with cuts until you could no longer pretend to count them or to trace them. They would have no nails. They had worn them off, pulling hides. Their knuckles were swollen so that their fingers spread out like a fan. There were men who worked in the cooking rooms in the midst of steam and sickening odors, by artificial light. In these rooms the germs of tuberculosis might live for 2 years, but the supply was renewed every hour. There were the beef luggers, who carried 200-pound quarters into the refrigerator cars, a fearful kind of work that began at 4 o'clock in the morning, and that wore out the most powerful men in a few years. There were those who worked in the chilling rooms, and whose special disease was rheumatism. The time limit that a man could work in the chilling rooms was said to be 5 years. There were the wool pluckers, whose hands went to pieces even sooner than the hands of the pickle men. For the pelts of the sheep had to be painted with acid to loosen the wool, and then the pluckers had to pull out this wool with their bare hands till the acid had eaten their fingers off. There were those who made the tins for the canned meat, and their hands, too, were a maze of cuts, and each cut represented a chance for blood poisoning. Some worked at the stamping machines, and it was seldom that one could work long there at the pace that was set, and not give out and forget himself, and have a part of his hand chopped off. There were the hoisters, as they were called, whose task it was to press the lever which lifted the dead cattle off the floor. They ran along upon a rafter, peering down through the damp and the steam, and as old Durham's architects had not built the killing room for the convenience of the hoisters, at every few feet they would have to stoop under a beam, say 4 feet above the one they ran on, which got them into the habit of stooping, so that in a few years they would be walking like chimpanzees. Worst of any, however, were the fertilizer men, and those who served in the cooking rooms. These people could not be shown to the visitor, for the odor of a fertilizer man would scare any ordinary visitor at 100 yards. And as for the other men, who worked in tank rooms full of steam, and in some of which there were open vats near the level of the floor, their peculiar trouble was that they fell into the vats, and when they were fished out, there was never enough of them left to be worth exhibiting. Sometimes they would be overlooked for days, till all but the bones of them had gone out to the world as Durham's pure leaf lard. Chapter 10. During the early part of the winter, the family had had money enough to live and a little over to pay their debts with. But when the earnings of Jurgis fell from $9 or $10 a week to 5 or 6, there was no longer anything to spare. The winter went, and the spring came, and found them still living thus from hand to mouth, hanging on day by day, with literally not a month's wages between them and starvation. Maria was in despair, for there was still no word about the reopening of the canning factory, and her savings were almost entirely gone. She had had to give up all idea of marrying then. The family could not get along without her, though for that matter she was likely soon to become a burden even upon them, for when her money was all gone, they would have to pay back what they owed her in board. So Jurgis and Ona and Teta Elzbieta would hold anxious conferences until late at night, trying to figure how they could manage this too without starving. Such were the cruel terms upon which their life was possible, that they might never have, nor expect, a single instant's respite from worry, a single instant in which they were not haunted by the thought of money. They would no sooner escape, as by a miracle, from one difficulty, than a new one would come into view. In addition to all their physical hardships, there was thus a constant strain upon their minds. They were harried all day and nearly all night by worry and fear. This was in truth not living. It was scarcely even existing, and they felt that it was too little for the price they paid. They were willing to work all the time. And when people did their best, ought they not to be able to keep alive? There seemed never to be an end to the things they had to buy and to the unforeseen contingencies. Once their water pipes froze and burst, and when, in their ignorance, they thawed them out, they had a terrifying flood in their house. It happened while the men were away, and poor Elzbieta rushed out into the street screaming for help, for she did not know whether the flood could be stopped or whether they were ruined for life. It was nearly as bad as the latter, they found in the end, for the plumber charged them 75 cents an hour and 75 cents for another man who had stood and watched him, and included all the time the two had been going and coming, and also a charge for all sorts of material and extras. And then again, when they went to pay their January's installment on the house, the agent terrified them by asking them if they had had the insurance attended to yet. In answer to their inquiry, he showed them a clause in the deed which provided that they were to keep the house insured for $1,000 as soon as the present policy ran out, which would happen in a few days. Poor Elzbieta, upon whom again fell the blow, demanded how much it would cost them. $7, the man said, and that night came Jurgis, grim and determined, requesting that the agent would be good enough to inform him, once for all, as to all the expenses they were liable for. The deed was signed now, he said, with sarcasm proper to the new way of life he had learned. The deed was signed, and so the agent had no longer anything to gain by keeping quiet. And Jurgis looked the fellow squarely in the eye, and so he did not waste any time in conventional protests, but read him the deed. They would have to renew the insurance every year. They would have to pay the taxes, about $10 a year. They would have to pay the water tax, about $6 a year. Jurgis silently resolved to shut off the hydrant. This, besides the interest and the monthly installments, would be all, unless by chance the city should happen to decide to put in a sewer or to lay a sidewalk. Yes, said the agent, they would have to have these, whether they wanted them or not, if the city said so. The sewer would cost them about $22, and the sidewalk $15 if it were wood, $25 if it were cement. So Jurgis went home again. It was a relief to know the worst, at any rate, so that he could no more be surprised by fresh demands. He saw now how they had been plundered, but they were in for it. There was no turning back. They could only go on and make the fight and win, for defeat was a thing that could not even be thought of. When the springtime came, they were delivered from the dreadful cold, and that was a great deal. But in addition, they had counted on the money they would not have to pay for coal, and it was just at this time that Maria's hoard began to fail. Then, too, the warm weather brought trials of its own. Each season had its trials, as they found. In the spring, there were cold rains that turned the streets into canals and bogs. The mud would be so deep that wagons would sink up to the hubs, so that half a dozen horses could not move them. Then, of course, it was impossible for anyone to get to work with dry feet, and this was bad for men that were poorly clad and shod, and still worse for women and children. Later came midsummer, with the stifling heat, when the dingy killing beds of Durham's became a very purgatory. One time in a single day, 3 men fell dead from sunstroke. All day long, the rivers of hot blood poured forth until, with the sun beating down and the air motionless, the stench was enough to knock a man over. All the old smells of a generation would be drawn out by this heat, for there was never any washing of the walls and rafters and pillars, and they were caked with the filth of a lifetime. The men who worked on the killing beds would come to reek with foulness, so that you could smell one of them 50 feet away. There was simply no such thing as keeping decent. The most careful man gave it up in the end, and wallowed in uncleanliness. There was not even a place where a man could wash his hands, and the men ate as much raw blood as food at dinner time. When they were at work, they could not even wipe off their faces. They were as helpless as newly born babies in that respect. And it may seem like a small matter, but when the sweat began to run down their necks and tickle them, or a fly to bother them, it was a torture like being burned alive. Whether it was the slaughterhouses or the dumps that were responsible, one could not say. But with the hot weather, there descended upon Packingtown a veritable Egyptian plague of flies. There could be no describing this. The houses would be black with them, There was no escaping. You might provide all your doors and windows with screens, but their buzzing outside would be like the swarming of bees, and whenever you opened the door, they would rush in as if a storm of wind were driving them. Perhaps the summertime suggests to you thoughts of the country, visions of green fields and mountains and sparkling lakes. It had no such suggestion for the people in the yards. The great packing machine ground on remorselessly, without thinking of green fields. And the men and women and children who were part of it never saw any green thing, not even a flower. 4 or 5 miles to the east of them lay the blue waters of Lake Michigan, but for all the good it did them, it might have been as far away as the Pacific Ocean. They had only Sundays, and then they were too tired to walk. They were tied to the great packing machine, and tied to it for life. The managers and superintendents and clerks of Packingtown were all recruited from another class, and never from the workers. They scorned the workers, the very meanest of them. A poor devil of a bookkeeper, who had been working in Durham's for 20 years at a salary of $6 a week, and might work there for 20 more and do no better, would yet consider himself a gentleman, as far removed as the poles from the most skilled worker on the killing beds. He would dress differently, and live in another part of the town, and come to work at a different hour of the day, and in every way make sure that he never rubbed elbows with a laboring man. Perhaps this was due to the repulsiveness of the work. At any rate, the people who worked with their hands were a class apart, and were made to feel it. In the late spring, the canning factory started up again. And so, once more, Maria was heard to sing, and the love music of Timotius took on a less melancholy tone. It was not for long, however, for a month or two later, a dreadful calamity fell upon Maria. Just 1 year and 3 days after she had begun work as a can painter, she lost her job. It was a long story. Maria insisted that it was because of her activity in the union. The packers, of course, had spies in all the unions, and in addition they made a practice of buying up a certain number of the union officials, as many as they thought they needed. So every week they received reports as to what was going on, and often they knew things before the members of the union knew them. Anyone who was considered to be dangerous by them would find that he was not a favorite with the boss, and Maria had been a great hand for going after the foreign people and preaching to them. However that might be, the known facts were that a few weeks before the factory closed, Maria had been cheated out of her pay for 300 cans. The girls worked at a long table, and behind them walked a woman with pencil and notebook, keeping count of the number they finished. This woman was, of course, only human and sometimes made mistakes. When this happened, there was no redress. If on Saturday you got less money than you had earned, you had to make the best of it. But Maria did not understand this, and made a disturbance. Maria's disturbances did not mean anything, and while she had known only Lithuanian and Polish, they had done no harm, for people only laughed at her and made her cry. But now, Maria was able to call names in English, and so she got the woman who made the mistake to disliking her. Probably, as Maria claimed, she made mistakes on purpose after that. At any rate, she made them, and the third time it happened, Maria went on the warpath and took the matter first to the forelady, and when she got no satisfaction there, to the superintendent. This was unheard of presumption, but the superintendent said he would see about it, which Maria took to mean that she was going to get her money. After waiting 3 days, she went to see the superintendent again. This time the man frowned and said that he had not had time to attend to it, and when Maria, against the advice and warning of everyone, tried it once more, he ordered her back to her work in a passion. Just how things happened after that, Maria was not sure. But that afternoon, the forelady told her that her services would not be any longer required. Poor Maria could not have been more dumbfounded had the woman knocked her over the head. At first, she could not believe what she heard, and then she grew furious and swore that she would come anyway, and the place belonged to her. In the end, she sat down in the middle of the floor and wept and wailed. It was a cruel lesson. But then Maria was headstrong. She should have listened to those who had had experience. The next time, she would know her place, as the forelady expressed it, and so Maria went out, and the family faced the problem of an existence again. It was especially hard this time, for Ona was to be confined before long, and Jorgis was trying hard to save up money for this. He had heard dreadful stories of the midwives, who grow as thick as fleas in Packingtown, and he had made up his mind that Ona must have a man doctor. Jorgis could be very obstinate when he wanted to, and he was, in this case, much to the dismay of the women, who felt that a man doctor was an impropriety, and that the matter really belonged to them. The cheapest doctor they could find would charge them $15, and perhaps more, when the bill came in. And here was Jorgis declaring that he would pay it, even if he had to stop eating in the meantime. Maria had only about $25 left. Day after day, she wandered about the yards, begging a job, but this time without hope of finding it. Maria could do the work of an able-bodied man when she was cheerful, but discouragement wore her out easily, and she would come home at night a pitiable object. She learned her lesson this time, poor creature. She learned it 10 times over. All the family learned it along with her, that when you have once got a job in Packingtown, you hang on to it, come what will. 4 weeks Maria hunted, and half of a fifth week. Of course she stopped paying her dues to the union. She lost all interest in the union, and cursed herself for a fool that she had ever been dragged into one. She had about made up her mind that she was a lost soul when somebody told her of an opening, and she went and got a place as a beef trimmer. She got this because the boss saw that she had the muscles of a man, and so he discharged a man and put Maria to do his work, paying her a little more than half what he had been paying before. When she first came to Packingtown, Maria would have scorned such work as this. She was in another canning factory, and her work was to trim the meat of those diseased cattle that Jorgis had been told about not long before. She was shut up in one of the rooms where the people seldom saw the daylight. Beneath her were the chilling rooms where the meat was frozen, and above her were the cooking rooms, and so she stood on an ice-cold floor while her head was often so hot that she could scarcely breathe. Trimming beef off the bones by the hundredweight, while standing up from early morning till late at night, with heavy boots on and the floor always damp and full of puddles, liable to be thrown out of work indefinitely because of a slackening in the trade, liable again to be kept overtime in rush seasons, and to be worked till she trembled in every nerve and lost her grip on her slimy knife and gave herself a poisoned wound. That was the new life that unfolded itself before Maria. But because Maria was a human horse, she merely laughed and went at it. It would enable her to pay her board again and keep the family going. And as for Timotius, well, they had waited a long time, and they could wait a little longer. They could not possibly get along upon his wages alone, and the family could not live without hers. He could come and visit her and sit in the kitchen and hold her hand, and he must manage to be content with that. But day by day, the music of Timotius's violin became more passionate and heartbreaking, and Maria would sit with her hands clasped and her cheeks wet, and all of her body a tremble, hearing in the wailing melodies the voices of the unborn generations which cried out in her for life. Maria's lesson came just in time to save Ona from a similar fate. Ona, too, was dissatisfied with her place and had far more reason than Maria. She did not tell half of her story at home because she saw it was a torment to Jorgis, and she was afraid of what he might do. For a long time, Ona had seen that Miss Henderson, the forelady in her department, did not like her. At first, she thought it was the old-time mistake she had made in asking for a holiday to get married. Then she concluded it must be because she did not give the forelady a present occasionally. She was the kind that took presents from the girls, Ona learned, and made all sorts of discriminations in favor of those who gave them. In the end, however, Ona discovered that it was even worse than that. Miss Henderson was a newcomer, and it was some time before rumor made her out, but finally it transpired that she was a kept woman, the former mistress of the superintendent of a department in the same building. He had put her there to keep her quiet, it seemed, and that not altogether with success, for once or twice they had been heard quarreling. She had the temper of a hyena, and soon the place she ran was a witch's cauldron. There were some of the girls who were of her own sort, who were willing to toady to her and flatter her, and these would carry tales about the rest. And so the Furies were unchained in the place. Worse than this, the woman lived in a bawdy house downtown with a coarse, red-faced Irishman named Connor. who was the boss of the loading gang outside, and would make free with the girls as they went to and from their work. In the slack seasons, some of them would go with Miss Henderson to this house downtown. In fact, it would not be too much to say that she managed her department at Brown's in conjunction with it. Sometimes women from the house would be given places alongside of decent girls, and after other decent girls had been turned off to make room for them. When you worked in this woman's department, the house downtown was never out of your thoughts all day. There were always whiffs of it to be caught, like the odor of the Packingtown rendering plants at night, when the wind shifted suddenly. There would be stories about it, going the rounds. The girls opposite you would be telling them and winking at you. In such a place, Ona would not have stayed a day, but for starvation. And as it was, she was never sure that she could stay the next day. She understood now that the real reason that Miss Henderson hated her was that she was a decent married girl, and she knew that the tale-bearers and the toadies hated her for the same reason and were doing their best to make her life miserable. But there was no place a girl could go in Packingtown if she was particular about things of this sort. There was no place in it where a prostitute could not get along better than a decent girl. Here was a population, low-class and mostly foreign, hanging always on the verge of starvation and dependent for its opportunities of life upon the whim of men every bit as brutal and unscrupulous as the old-time slave traders. Under such circumstances, immorality was exactly as inevitable and as prevalent as it was under the system of chattel slavery. Things that were quite unspeakable went on there in the packing houses all the time and were taken for granted by everybody. Only they did not show, as in the old slavery times, because there was no difference in color between master and slave. One morning Ona stayed home, and Jorgis had the man doctor, according to his whim, and she was safely delivered of a fine baby. It was an enormous big boy, and Ona was such a tiny creature herself that it seemed quite incredible. Jorgis would stand and gaze at the stranger by the hour, unable to believe that it had really happened. The coming of this boy was a decisive event with Jorgis. It made him, irrevocably, a family man. It killed the last, lingering impulse that he might have had to go out in the evenings and sit and talk with the men in the saloons. There was nothing he cared for now so much as to sit and look at the baby. This was very curious, for Jorgis had never been interested in babies before. But then, this was a very unusual sort of a baby. He had the brightest little black eyes, and little black ringlets all over his head. He was the living image of his father, everybody said, and Jorgis found this a fascinating circumstance. It was sufficiently perplexing that this tiny mite of life should have come into the world at all in the manner that it had. That it should have come with a comical imitation of its father's nose was simply uncanny. Perhaps, Jorgis thought, this was intended to signify that it was his baby, that it was his and Ona's to care for all its life. Jorgis had never possessed anything nearly so interesting. A baby was, when you came to think about it, assuredly a marvelous possession. It would grow up to be a man, a human soul, with a personality all its own, a will of its own. Such thoughts would keep haunting Jorgis, filling him with all sorts of strange and almost painful excitements. He was wonderfully proud of little Antanas. He was curious about all the details of him, the washing and the dressing and the eating and the sleeping of him, and asked all sorts of absurd questions. It took him quite a while to get over his alarm at the incredible shortness of the little creature's legs. Jorgis had, alas, very little time to see his baby. He never felt the chains about him more than just then. When he came home at night, the baby would be asleep, and it would be the merest chance if he woke before Jorgis had to go to sleep himself. Then in the morning, there was no time to look at him, so really the only chance the father had was on Sundays. This was more cruel yet for Ona, who ought to have stayed home and nursed him, the doctor said, for her own health as well as the baby's. But Ona had to go to work and leave him for Teta Elzbieta to feed upon the pale blue poison that was called milk at the corner grocery. Ona's confinement lost her only a week's wages. She would go to the factory the second Monday, and the best that Jorgis could persuade her was to ride in the car, and let him run along behind and help her to Brown's when she alighted. After that, it would be all right, said Ona. It was no strain sitting still, sewing hams all day, and if she waited longer, she might find that her dreadful forelady had put someone else in her place. That would be a greater calamity than ever now, Ona continued, on account of the baby. They would all have to work harder now on his account. It was such a responsibility. They must not have the baby grow up to suffer as they had. And this indeed had been the first thing that Jorgis had thought of himself. He had clenched his hands and braced himself anew for the struggle, for the sake of that tiny mite of human possibility. And so Ona went back to Brown's and saved her place in a week's wages. And so she gave herself some one of the thousand ailments that women group under the title of womb trouble, and was never again a well person as long as she lived. It is difficult to convey in words all that this meant to Ona. It seemed such a slight offense, and the punishment was so out of all proportion that neither she nor anyone else ever connected the two. Womb trouble, to Ona, did not mean a specialist's diagnosis in a course of treatment, and perhaps an operation or two. It meant simply headaches, and pains in the back, and depression, and heart sickness, and neuralgia, when she had to go to work in the rain. The great majority of the women who worked in Packingtown suffered in the same way, and from the same cause. So it was not deemed a thing to see the doctor about. Instead, Ona would try patent medicines, one after another, as her friends told her about them. As these all contained alcohol, or some other stimulant, she found that they all did her good while she took them. And so she was always chasing the phantom of good health and losing it because she was too poor to continue. Chapter 11. During the summer, the packing houses were in full activity again, and Jorgis made more money. He did not make so much, however, as he had the previous summer, for the packers took on more hands. There were new men every week, it seemed. It was a regular system, and this number they would keep over to the next slack season so that everyone would have less than ever. Sooner or later, by this plan, they would have all the floating labor of Chicago trained to do their work. And how very cunning a trick was that. The men were to teach new hands, who would some day come and break their strike. In meantime, they were kept so poor that they could not prepare for the trial. But let no one suppose that this superfluity of employees meant easier work for anyone. On the contrary, the speeding up seemed to be growing more savage all the time. They were continually inventing new devices to crowd the work on. It was, for all the world, like the thumbscrew of the medieval torture chamber. They would get new pacemakers and pay them more. They would drive the men on with new machinery. It was said that in the hog-killing rooms, the speed at which the hogs moved was determined by clockwork, and that it was increased a little every day. In piecework, they would reduce the time, requiring the same work in a shorter time and paying the same wages. And then, after the workers accustomed themselves to this new speed, they would reduce the rate of payment to correspond with the reduction in time. They had done this so often in the canning establishments that the girls were fairly desperate. Their wages had gone down by a full third in the past 2 years, and a storm of discontent was brewing that was likely to break any day. Only a month after Maria had become a beef trimmer, the canning factory that she had left posted a cut that would divide the girls' earnings almost squarely in half. And so great was the indignation at this that they marched out without even a parley, and organized in the street outside. One of the girls had read somewhere that a red flag was the proper symbol for oppressed workers, and so they mounted one, and paraded all about the yards, yelling with rage. A new union was the result of this outburst, but the impromptu strike went to pieces in 3 days, owing to the rush of new labor. At the end of it, the girl who had carried the red flag went down and got a position in a great department store at a salary of $2.50 a week. Jorgis and Ona heard these stories with dismay, for there was no telling when their own time might come. Once or twice there had been rumors that one of the big houses was going to cut its unskilled men to 15 cents an hour, and Jorgis knew that if this was done, his turn would come soon. He had learned by this time that Packingtown was really not a number of firms at all, but one great firm, the Beef Trust. And every week the managers of it got together and compared notes, and there was one scale for all the workers in the yards and one standard of efficiency. Jorgis was told that they also fixed the price they would pay for beef on the hoof and the price of all dressed meat in the country. But that was something he did not understand or care about. The only one who was not afraid of a cut was Maria, who congratulated herself somewhat naively that there had been one in her place only a short time before she came. Maria was getting to be a skilled beef trimmer and was mounting to the heights again. During the summer and fall, Jorgis and Ona managed to pay her back the last penny they owed her, and so she began to have a bank account. Timoshus had a bank account also, and they ran a race, and began to figure upon household expenses once more. The possession of vast wealth entails cares and responsibilities, however, as poor Maria found out. She had taken the advice of a friend and invested her savings in a bank on Ashland Avenue. Of course, she knew nothing about it, except that it was big and imposing. What possible chance has a poor foreign working girl to understand the banking business, as it is conducted in this land of frenzied finance? So Maria lived in a continual dread lest something should happen to her bank, and would go out of her way mornings to make sure that it was still there. Her principal thought was of fire, for she had deposited her money in bills and was afraid that if they were burned up, the bank would not give her any others. Jorgis made fun of her for this, for he was a man and was proud of his superior knowledge, telling her that the bank had fireproof vaults and all its millions of dollars hidden safely away in them. However, one morning, Maria took her usual detour and, to her horror and dismay, saw a crowd of people in front of the bank, filling the avenue solid for half a block. All the blood went out of her face for terror. She broke into a run, shouting to the people to ask what was the matter, but not stopping to hear what they answered, till she had come to where the throng was so dense that she could no longer advance. There was a run on the bank, they told her then, but she did not know what that was, and turned from one person to another, trying in an agony of fear to make out what they meant. Had something gone wrong with the bank? Nobody was sure, but they thought so. Couldn't she get her money? There was no telling. The people were afraid not, and they were all trying to get it. It was too early yet to tell anything. The bank would not open for nearly 3 hours, so in a frenzy of despair, Maria began to claw her way toward the doors of this building, through a throng of men, women, and children, all as excited as herself. It was a scene of wild confusion, women shrieking and wringing their hands and fainting, and men fighting and trampling down everything in their way. In the midst of the melee, Maria recollected that she did not have her bank book and could not get her money anyway, so she fought her way out and started on a run for home. This was fortunate for her, for a few minutes later the police reserves arrived. In half an hour, Maria was back, Teta Elzbieta with her, both of them breathless with running and sick with fear. The crowd was now formed in a line, extending for several blocks, with 50 policemen keeping guard, and so there was nothing for them to do but to take their places at the end of it. At 9 o'clock, the bank opened and began to pay the waiting throng, but then what good did that do Maria, who saw 3,000 people before her, enough to take out the last penny of 12 banks? To make matters worse, a drizzling rain came up and soaked them to the skin, yet all the morning they stood there, creeping slowly toward the goal. All the afternoon they stood there, heartsick, seeing that the hour of closing was coming and that they were going to be left out. Maria made up her mind that, come what might, she would stay there and keep her place, but as nearly all did the same. All through the long, cold night, she got very little closer to the bank for that. Toward evening, Jorgis came. He had heard the story from the children, and he brought some food and dry wraps, which made it a little easier. The next morning, before daybreak, came a bigger crowd than ever, and more policemen from downtown. Maria held on like grim death, and toward afternoon she got into the bank and got her money, all in big silver dollars, a handkerchief full. When she had once got her hands on them, her fear vanished, and she wanted to put them back again. But the man at the window was savage and said that the bank would receive no more deposits from those who had taken part in the run. So Maria was forced to take her dollars home with her, watching to right and left, expecting every instant that someone would try to rob her, and when she got home she was not much better off. until she could find another bank. There was nothing to do but sew them up in her clothes. And so Maria went about for a week or more, loaded down with bullion, and afraid to cross the street in front of the house, because Jorgis told her she would sink out of sight in the mud. Weighted this way, she made her way to the yards, again in fear, this time to see if she had lost her place, but fortunately, about 10% of the working people of Packingtown had been depositors in that bank, and it was not convenient to discharge that many at once. The cause of the panic had been the attempt of a policeman to arrest a drunken man in a saloon next door, which had drawn a crowd at the hour the people were on their way to work, and so started the run. About this time, Jorgis and Ona also began a bank account. Besides having paid Jonas and Maria, they had almost paid for their furniture, and could have that little sum to count on. So long as each of them could bring home $9 or $10 a week, they were able to get along finely. Also, election day came round again, and Jorgis made half a week's wages out of that, all net profit. It was a very close election that year, and the echoes of the battle reached even to Packingtown. The two rival sets of grafters hired halls and set off fireworks and made speeches to try to get the people interested in the matter. Although Jorgis did not understand it all, he knew enough by this time to realize that it was not supposed to be right to sell your vote. However, as everyone did it, and his refusal to join would not have made the slightest difference in the results, the idea of refusing would have seemed absurd, had it ever come into his head. Now chill winds and shortening days began to warn them that the winter was coming again. It seemed as if the respite had been too short. They had not had time enough to get ready for it, but still it came, inexorably, and the hunted look began to come back into the eyes of little Stanislovas. The prospect struck fear to the heart of Jorgis also, for he knew that Ona was not fit to face the cold and the snowdrifts this year. And suppose that some day when a blizzard struck them and the cars were not running, Ona should have to give it up and should come home the next day to find that her place had been given to someone who lived nearer and could be depended on. It was the week before Christmas that the first great storm came, and then the soul of Jorgis rose up within him like a sleeping lion. There were 4 days that the Ashland Avenue cars were stalled, and in those days, for the first time in his life, Jorgis knew what it was to be really opposed. He had faced difficulties before, but they had been child's play. Now, there was a death struggle, and all the furies were unchained within him. The first morning, they set out 2 hours before dawn. Ona wrapped all in blankets and tossed upon his shoulder like a sack of meal, and the little boy bundled nearly out of sight, hanging by his coattails. There was a raging blast beating in his face, and the thermometer stood below zero. The snow was never short of his knees, and in some of the drifts it was nearly up to his armpits. It would catch his feet and try to trip him. It would build itself into a wall before him to beat him back, and he would fling himself into it, plunging like a wounded buffalo, puffing and snorting in rage. So foot by foot he drove his way. And when at last he came to Durham's, he was staggering and almost blind, and leaned against a pillar, gasping and thanking God that the cattle came late to the killing beds that day. In the evening, the same thing had to be done again, and because Jorgis could not tell what hour of the night he would get off, he got a saloon keeper to let Ona sit and wait for him in a corner. Once it was 11 o'clock at night, and black as the pit, but still they got home. That blizzard knocked many a man out, for the crowd outside begging for work was never greater, and the packers would not wait long for anyone. When it was over, the soul of Jorgis was a song, for he had met the enemy and conquered, and felt himself the master of his fate. So it might be with some monarch of the forest that has vanquished his foes in fair fight and then falls into some cowardly trap in the nighttime. A time of peril on the killing beds was when a steer broke loose. Sometimes, in the haste of speeding up, they would dump one of the animals out on the floor before it was fully stunned, and it would get up upon its feet and run amok. Then there would be a yell of warning. The men would drop everything and dash for the nearest pillar, slipping here and there on the floor and tumbling over each other. This was bad enough in the summer, when a man could see, In the wintertime, it was enough to make your hair stand up, for the room would be so full of steam that you could not make anything out 5 feet in front of you. To be sure, the steer was generally blind and frantic and not especially bent on hurting anyone, but think of the chances of running upon a knife while nearly every man had one in his hand. And then, to cap the climax, the floor boss would come rushing up with a rifle and begin blazing away. It was in one of these melees that Jorgis fell into his trap. That is the only word to describe it. It was so cruel and so utterly not to be foreseen. At first, he hardly noticed it. It was such a slight accident. Simply that in leaping out of the way, he turned his ankle. There was a twinge of pain, but Jorgis was used to pain and did not coddle himself. When he came to walk home, however, he realized that it was hurting him a great deal, and in the morning his ankle was swollen out nearly double its size, and he could not get his foot into his shoe. Still, even then, he did nothing more than swear a little and wrapped his foot in old rags and hobbled out to take the car. It chanced to be a rush day at Durham's, and all the morning long he limped about with his aching foot. By noontime, the pain was so great that it made him faint, and after a couple of hours in the afternoon, he was fairly beaten and had to tell the boss. They sent for the company doctor, and he examined the foot and told Jorgis to go home to bed, adding that he had probably laid himself up for months by his folly. The injury was not one that Durham and company could be held responsible for. And so that was all there was to it, so far as the doctor was concerned. Jorgis got home somehow, scarcely able to see for the pain and with an awful terror in his soul. Elzbieta helped him into bed and bandaged his injured foot with cold water and tried hard not to let him see her dismay. When the rest came home at night, she met them outside and told them, and they too put on a cheerful face, saying it would only be for a week or two, and that they would pull him through. When they had gotten him to sleep, however, they sat by the kitchen fire and talked it over in frightened whispers. They were in for a siege. That was plainly to be seen. Jorgis had only about $60 in the bank, and the slack season was upon them. Both Jonas and Maria might soon be earning no more than enough to pay their board, and besides that, there were only the wages of Ona and the pittance of the little boy. There was the rent to pay, and still some on the furniture. There was the insurance just due, and every month there was sack after sack of coal. It was January, midwinter, an awful time to have to face privation. Deep snows would come again, and who would carry Ona to her work now? She might lose her place. She was almost certain to lose it. And then little Stanislovas began to whimper. Who would take care of him? It was dreadful that an accident of this sort, that no man can help, should have meant such suffering. The bitterness of it was the daily food and drink of Jorgis. It was of no use for them to try to deceive him. He knew as much about the situation as they did, and he knew that the family might literally starve to death. The worry of it fairly ate him up. He began to look haggard the first 2 or 3 days of it. In truth, it was almost maddening for a strong man like him, a fighter, to have to lie there helpless on his back. It was for all the world the old story of Prometheus bound. As Jorgis lay on his bed, hour after hour, there came to him emotions that he had never known before. Before this, he had met life with a welcome. It had its trials, but none that a man could not face. But now, in the nighttime, when he lay tossing about, there would come stalking into his chamber a grisly phantom, the sight of which made his flesh to curl and his hair to bristle up. It was like seeing the world falling away from underneath his feet, like plunging down into a bottomless abyss, into yawning caverns of despair. It might be true, then, after all, what others had told him about life, that the best powers of a man might not be equal to it. It might be true that, strive as he would, toil as he would, he might fail and go down and be destroyed. The thought of this was like an icy hand at his heart. The thought that here, in this ghastly home of all horror, he and all those who were dear to him might lie and perish of starvation and cold, and there would be no ear to hear their cry, no hand to help them. It was true. that here in this huge city, with its stores of heaped-up wealth, human creatures might be hunted down and destroyed by the wild beast powers of nature, just as truly as ever they were in the days of the cavemen. Ona was now making about $30 a month, and Stanislovas about $13. To add to this, there was the board of Jonas and Maria, about $45, deducting from this the rent, interest, and installments on the furniture, they had left $60, and deducting the coal, they had $50. They did without everything that human beings could do without. They went in old and ragged clothing that left them at the mercy of the cold, and when the children's shoes wore out, they tied them up with string. Half invalid as she was, Ona would do herself harm by walking in the rain and cold when she ought to have ridden. They bought literally nothing but food, and still they could not keep alive on $50 a month. They might have done it, if only they could have gotten pure food and at fair prices, or if only they had known what to get, if they had not been so pitifully ignorant. But they had come to a new country, where everything was different, including the food. They had always been accustomed to eat a great deal of smoked sausage, and how could they know that what they bought in America was not the same, that its color was made by chemicals, and its smoky flavor by more chemicals, and that it was full of potato flour besides. Potato flour is the waste of potato after the starch and alcohol have been extracted. It has no more food value than so much wood, and as its use as a food adulterant is a penal offense in Europe. Thousands of tons of it are shipped to America every year. It was amazing what quantities of food such as this were needed every day. By 11 hungry persons, $1.65 a day was simply not enough to feed them, and there was no use trying. And so each week they made an inroad upon the pitiful little bank account that Ona had begun. Because the account was in her name, it was possible for her to keep this a secret from her husband and to keep the heart sickness of it for her own. It would have been better if Jurgis had been really ill, if he had not been able to think, for he had no resources such as most invalids have. All he could do was to lie there and toss about from side to side. Now and then he would break into cursing regardless of everything, and now and then his impatience would get the better of him, and he would try to get up, and poor Teta Elzbieta would have to plead with him in frenzy. Elzbieta was all alone with him the greater part of the time. She would sit and smooth his forehead by the hour and talk to him and try to make him forget. Sometimes it would be too cold for the children to go to school, and they would have to play in the kitchen where Jurgis was, because it was the only room that was half warm. These were dreadful times. For Jurgis would get as cross as any bear. He was scarcely to be blamed, for he had enough to worry him, and it was hard when he was trying to take a nap to be kept awake by noisy and peevish children. Elzbieta's only resource in those times was little Antanas. Indeed, it would be hard to say how they could have gotten along at all if it had not been for little Antanas. It was the one consolation of Jurgis's long imprisonment that now he had time to look at his baby. Teta Elzbieta would put the clothes basket in which the baby slept alongside of his mattress, and Jurgis would lie upon one elbow and watch him by the hour, imagining things. Then little Antanas would open his eyes. He was beginning to take notice of things now, and he would smile. How he would smile. So Jurgis would begin to forget and be happy, because he was in a world where there was a thing so beautiful as the smile of little Antanas, and because such a world could not but be good at the heart of it. He looked more like his father every hour, Elzbieta would say, and said it many times a day, because she saw that it pleased Jurgis. The poor little terror-stricken woman was planning all day and all night to soothe the prison giant who was entrusted to her care. Jurgis, who knew nothing about the age-long and everlasting hypocrisy of women, would take the bait and grin with delight. And then he would hold his finger in front of little Antanas' eyes and move it this way and that, and laugh with glee to see the baby follow it. There is no pet quite so fascinating as a baby. He would look into Jurgis's face with such uncanny seriousness, and Jurgis would start to cry. "Palauk, look!" Muma, he knows his papa. He does. He does. Tumana Shirdela, the little rascal. Chapter 12. For 3 weeks after his injury, Jurgis never got up from bed. It was a very obstinate sprain. The swelling would not go down, and the pain still continued. At the end of that time, however, he could contain himself no longer, and began trying to walk a little every day, laboring to persuade himself that he was better. No arguments could stop him, and 3 or 4 days later he declared that he was going back to work. He limped to the cars and got to Brown's, where he found that the boss had kept his place. That is, was willing to turn out into the snow the poor devil he had hired in the meantime. Every now and then the pain would force Jurgis to stop work, but he stuck it out nearly an hour before closing. Then he was forced to acknowledge that he could not go on without fainting. It almost broke his heart to do it, and he stood there leaning against a pillar and weeping like a child. Two of the men had to help him to the car, and when he got out, he had to sit down and wait in the snow till someone came along. So they put him to bed again and sent for the doctor, as they ought to have done in the beginning. It transpired that he had twisted a tendon out of place and could never have gotten well without attention. Then he gripped the sides of the bed and shut his teeth together and turned white with agony while the doctor pulled and wrenched away at his swollen ankle. When finally the doctor left, he told him that he would have to lie quiet for 2 months, and that if he went to work before that time, he might lame himself for life. 3 days later, there came another heavy snowstorm, and Jonas and Maria and Ona and little Stanislavas all set out together, an hour before daybreak, to try to get to the yards. About noon, the last two came back, the boy screaming with pain. His fingers were all frosted, it seemed. They had had to give up trying to get to the yards, and had nearly perished in a drift. All that they knew how to do was to hold the frozen fingers near the fire, and so little Stanislava spent most of the day dancing about in horrible agony, till Jurgis flew into a passion of nervous rage and swore like a madman, declaring that he would kill him if he did not stop. All that day and night the family was half crazed with fear that Ona and the boy had lost their places. And in the morning they set out, earlier than ever, after the little fellow had been beaten with a stick by Jurgis. There could be no trifling in a case like this. It was a matter of life and death. Little Stanislavas could not be expected to realize that he might a great deal better freeze in the snowdrift than lose his job at the lard machine. Ona was quite certain that she would find her place gone, and was all unnerved when she finally got to Brown's and found that the forelady herself had failed to come, and was therefore compelled to be lenient. One of the consequences of this episode was that the first joints of the three of the little boy's fingers were permanently disabled, and another, that thereafter he always had to be beaten before he set out to work whenever there was fresh snow on the ground. Jurgis was called upon to do the beating, and as it hurt his foot, he did it with a vengeance. But it did not tend to add to the sweetness of his temper. They say that the best dog will turn cross if he be kept trained all the time, and it was the same with the man. He had not a thing to do all day but lie and curse his fate, and the time came when he wanted to curse everything. This was never for very long, however, for when Ona began to cry, Jurgis could not stay angry. The poor fellow looked like a homeless ghost, with his cheeks sunken in and his long black hair straggling into his eyes. He was too discouraged to cut it, or to think about his appearance. His muscles were wasting away, and what were left were soft and flabby. He had no appetite, and they could not afford to tempt him with delicacies. It was better, he said, that he should not eat. It was a saving. About the end of March, he'd got a hold of Ona's bank book, and learned that there was only $3 left to them in the world. But perhaps the worst of the consequences of this long siege was that they lost another member of their family. Brother Jonas disappeared. One Saturday night he did not come home, and thereafter all their efforts to get trace of him were futile. It was said by the boss at Durham's that he had gotten his week's money and left there. That might not be true, of course, for sometimes they would say that when a man had been killed, It was the easiest way out of it for all concerned. When, for instance, a man had fallen into one of the rendering tanks and had been made into pure leaf lard and peerless fertilizer, there was no use letting the fact out and making his family unhappy. More probable, however, was the theory that Jonas had deserted them, had gone on the road, seeking happiness. He had been discontented for a long time, and not without some cause. He paid good board, and was yet obliged to live in a family where nobody had enough to eat. And Maria would keep giving them all her money, and of course he could not but feel that he was called upon to do the same. Then there were crying brats, and all sorts of misery. A man would have had to be a good deal of a hero to stand it all without grumbling, and Jonas was not in the least a hero. He was simply a weather-beaten old fellow who liked to have a good supper and sit in the corner by the fire and smoke his pipe in peace before he went to bed. Here there was not room by the fire, and through the winter the kitchen had seldom been warm enough for comfort. So, with the springtime, what was more likely than that the wild idea of escaping had come to him? 2 years he had been yoked like a horse to a half-ton truck in Durham's dark cellars, with never a rest save on Sundays and 4 holidays in the year, and with never a word of thanks. Only kicks and blows and curses, such as no decent dog would have stood. And now the winter was over, and the spring winds were blowing, and with a day's walk a man might put the smoke of Packingtown behind him forever, and be where the grass was green and the flowers all the colors of the rainbow. But now the income of the family was cut down more than one-third, and the food demand was cut only 1/11, so that they were worse off than ever. Also, they were borrowing money from Maria and eating up her bank account, and spoiling once again her hopes of marriage and happiness. And they were even going into debt to Timotius Kushleka, and letting him impoverish himself. Poor Timotius was a man without any relatives, and with a wonderful talent besides, and he ought to have made money and prospered, but he had fallen in love, and so given hostages to fortune, and was doomed to be dragged down too. So it was finally decided that 2 more of the children would have to leave school. Next to Stanislavas, who was now 15, there was a girl, little Katrina, who was 2 years younger, and then 2 boys, Vilimas, who was 11, and Nikolaus, who was 10. Both of these last were bright boys, and there was no reason why their family should starve, when tens of thousands of children, no older, were earning their own livings. So one morning, they were given a quarter apiece in a roll with a sausage in it, and with their minds top-heavy with good advice, were sent out to make their way to the city and learn to sell newspapers. They came back late at night in tears, having walked the 5 or 6 miles to report that a man had offered to take them to a place where they sold newspapers, and had taken their money and gone into a store to get them, and never more been seen. So they both received a whipping, and the next morning set out again. This time they found the newspaper place, and procured their stock. And after wandering about till nearly noontime, saying, "Paper!" to everyone they saw, they had all their stock taken away, and received a thrashing besides from a big newsman upon whose territory they had trespassed. Fortunately, however, they had already sold some papers, and came back with nearly as much as they started with. After a week of mishaps such as these, the 2 little fellows began to learn the ways of the trade, the names of the different papers, and how many of each to get, and what sort of people to offer them to, and where to go and where to stay away from. After this, leaving home at 4 o'clock in the morning and running about the streets, first with morning papers and then with evening, they might come home late at night with 20 or 30 cents apiece, possibly as much as 40 cents. From this, they had to deduct their car fare, since the distance was so great, but after a while they made friends and learned still more, and then they would save their car fare. They would get on a car when the conductor was not looking and hide in the crowd, and 3 times out of 4 he would not ask for their fares, either not seeing them or thinking they had already paid. Or if he did ask, they would hunt through their pockets and then begin to cry and either have their fares paid by some kind old lady or else try the trick again on a new car. All this was fair play, they felt. Whose fault was it that at the hours when working men were going to their work and back, the cars were so crowded that the conductors could not collect all the fares. And besides, the companies were thieves, people said, had stolen all their franchises with the help